Now, our next guest is an investigative journalist, and he is also editor of his own website. He's joining us from the west side of the main island of Japan. I've just given away who this is. If you follow his work, you'll know exactly who I'm talking about. This is James Corbett, editor of the Corbett Report. James, thank you for joining us this Sunday.
Thank you so much for having me back on, Patrick. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
You know, likewise, James. And, you know, the reason I got in touch with you, James, because I saw immediately you put out a video fairly quickly on the Panama Papers. And this is like all the rage throughout most media outlets. And when I first saw this story, I think you and I were thinking similar things. I was like, well, what's the big deal here? I see a lot of fireworks, but I was looking for the beef. And I'm still searching for it. This story has spun off into so many different directions in a week. And I brought you on because I know you've been following it and you've got a fairly good take on it. My take on it, on the Panama Papers, is that, and I've said this on another show this afternoon, I think it's a limited hangout. I don't even think you could call this a leak, really. It's a hack. And if it was a leak, why didn't they just dump everything on WikiLeaks and let the world sift through it? But this is the world we're living in, James, is where you have these staged, managed media events where there's a select few establishment media outlets that manage somehow. And in a way, I'm saying Operation Mockingbird seems to have gone global. This is a global consortium of selected journalists or elite media outlets that seem to be managing material that's supposedly a leak. But that's...
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And yes, of course, we're talking about the ICIJ, this International Consortium of International Journalists, or whatever that exactly stands for, that is the organization that the Süddeutsche Zeitung turned to when they received this data dump from whatever quote-unquote whistleblower dumped it on them. And yes, of course, it has...
James,
usual...
I've got the name of the whistleblower, James.
Oh,
his name is John Doe.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Good lead. Let's narrow that down.
Last name Doe, and that's D-O-E, by the way. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I do actually have some interesting information that no one I've seen has actually pointed out yet, except for one commenter on the Zero Hedge website, and not in the article, but in a comment. But we'll get to that in a moment. But of course, this ICIJ has the usual types of connections that we would expect from an organization like this that has the resources to marshal over 300 journalists from different countries around the world, over 100 major media institutions like The Guardian and what have you, the usual suspects of the MSM. Well, it has the usual funders, the Open Society Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Ford Foundation. These types of names, of course, we would expect. And that's, again, it's not to absolutely nothing surprising there. Although, even bringing up the idea that the ICIJ is an institution that is funded by such people is apparently cue scary music, conspiracy theory, according to WNYC's On the Media, which took the time to single out me and the video that I did on the Panama Papers earlier this week, where they were talking about the counterintuitive conspiracy of the Panama Papers, where they say, look at all this actual data we have of corruption, and these crazy conspiracy theorists are still not happy with it. They think there might be something more to this.
Most of these theories revolve around the fact that this comes from an unusually named organization, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Their webpage lists all their funders, which includes the Ford Foundation, Carnegie Endowment, Rockefeller Family Fund, and the Open Society Foundations, founded by George Soros, who is a major progressive political donor to conspiracy theorists, who often tie a lot of these organizations to the Illuminati and Bohemian Grove and a lot of other secret societies. I mean, this is...
Let me stop you there, Jennings. I want to play you a piece of tape, an example of what you are describing. Mm-hmm. This is a guy named James Corbett, described as a, quote, popular conspiracy theory touting fringe journalist. And he himself is looking at the ICIJ's website.
Oh, Open Society Foundation. Where have I heard of that before? Oh, the Ford Foundation. It just so happens that their targets, the people that they've found the goods on, are either directly in the crosshairs of the State Department or people that are really just collateral damage or people that they might just want to hold something over. The King of Saudi Arabia, for instance.
The funders that he's describing, it's not Henry Ford's ghost who's running the Ford Foundation. It is a foundation that has underwritten some of the most important do-gooder projects for many decades.
Okay. Well, let me just stop you there. In a counterintuitive conspiracies, let's go to the Brookings Institute. They've released their counterintuitive conspiracy theory, and it says this. According to the Brookings Institute, I think yesterday, the Panama Papers were created by Putin, and in order to create the impression that Russia was under attack and to blackmail those who weren't mentioned in the Panama Papers, this would be U.S. interests that were missing from this data dump. So this is what Brookings put out, and I saw this in another outlet as well. So I think some of these mainstream organizations are some of the best sources of conspiracy theories these days.
Exactly right. And interestingly, that crazy conspiracy theory has been picked up by the MSM. For example, I saw it in The Independent, which had some sort of headline about the not-so-crazy conspiracy theory about the Panama Papers. And of course, they're citing Clifford G. Gaddy, the senior fellow of foreign policy for the Brookings Institution. So yes, that objective paragon of virtue at Brookings, who are telling us, yes, it was all the Russians. Which is, I mean, it's ridiculous on its face for a number of reasons, one of which is because of that interesting little nugget about John Doe that we have. Again, this is directly from the ICIJ, but no one that I've seen has pointed this out, again, except for this one commenter on Zero Hedge. It says directly on the ICIJ press release about the Panama Papers that about 2 years ago, i.e. 1 year before the Panama Papers dump on Süddeutsche Zeitung, 2 years ago, there was already a whistleblower who had sold internal Mossack Fonseca data to the German authorities. But the dataset was much older and smaller in scope. While it addressed a few hundred offshore companies, the Panama Papers provide data on some 214,000 companies.
So interesting.
It goes on to say that in the wake of that data purchase, there were a number of raids that, on homes and offices that were conducted. For example, the Commerce Bank, and also dealings with HSH, Nordbank, and Hypoverinsbank. These different firms agreed to pay fines of around 20 million euros, respectively. So this had already gone on, and then it goes on to say that other countries have also acquired data from this initial smaller leak, among them the US, the UK, and Iceland. Now, think about the implications of this. There had been a whistleblower a year before this newer whistleblower, or maybe it's the same whistleblower, but at any rate, from the same data set of information from Mossack Fonseca that sold that data to the German authorities. They purchased that data from some whistleblower and then started raiding different banks and managed to get 20 million euros out of it. And they also, this data also ended up with the US, the UK, and Iceland, whether from a different deal by this whistleblower or maybe they got it from the Germans. But either way, this data was already sold from some anonymous quote-unquote whistleblower. I mean, think about the ramifications of that. Do you think that the NATO Western intelligence agencies of Germany and the US and the UK, all of whom have been involved with this initial earlier leak, didn't put the resources of their intelligence agencies into finding out who this anonymous whistleblower was 2 years ago? And if they did, which they almost certainly did, unless, of course, it was an intelligence op from the beginning, which is also very much a possibility, at any rate, it becomes an intelligence op by proxy when they find out who it was and basically make sure that there's no leaks to be plugged. And then the other implication of this is, I mean, by what authority does Germany or any other government go around dealing with whistleblowers, giving them money for data that's leaked? I mean, technically, this could be a crime of some sort, depending. And and what money was issued, how much did they pay, and under what circumstances? And then what about that data? Who has access to that data? What if there are documents pertaining to German officials or US or UK or Icelandic officials that were in that initial data that have been scrubbed by the agency that purchased this? I mean, that nugget of information has so many possible tangential meanings to it that have not been explored at all in the talk about this newer leak.
I think you found a major crack there, James, I think, because here's what pops up in my head. Firstly, chain of custody. So we've got an issue with the chain of custody, potentially, of this data. That's a major, I mean, that pretty much taints everything that happens after that, okay? The other is due process. If this was handed to German authorities and it had to do primarily with Panama, the first step would be in the spirit of international cooperation for German authorities to fly down to Panama and go to their authorities and say, guys, what's going on? We've got this. You know, we're going to have to sort this out and maybe bring in some other countries or authorities to do that. So regulatory authorities. But I think you've definitely cracked something. There's a line between Panama and Germany initially on this. So we could say definitely German intelligence is involved. German government's involved. To what level? Is it at the source? We're not sure. But what I found, James, is that all of these Western agencies or the members of what we might call the Five Eyes or the Six Eyes, and that's not just from a James Bond film. This is real. They have interagency cooperation on so many different levels, not just surveillance and data, but also in terms of intelligence operations, basically. So there is these links between the CIA, German intelligence, MI6, French intelligence, and they do work together.
That's absolutely true, absolutely admitted. I don't think there's any doubt about that. There are instances in which I'm sure some of these agencies are backstabbing each other, but at the end of the day, they do certainly share information, and that should be kept in mind. And we should, again, look into someone of these intrepid 300 journalists should look into that initial leak and how it was sold and to whom it was sold and for what price and under what circumstances and what data was in that initial leak and how was that shared with other agents. I mean, just, again, that is an incredibly important part of this story that is just not being paid attention to.
So technically that's theft and then trafficking the information for money with government bodies. Is that kind of like,
well, especially because it's an international sale at that point. I mean, whatever whistleblower was leaking this data is getting it from Panama and selling it to the German government directly. Again, under what circumstances could that possibly come about? Even if the data was handed over to the German government, that would be one thing. And as you say, there would be cooperation with the Panamanian authorities. But the idea that it was sold to Germany and they purchased it, again, it's just mind-blowing that this little nugget has not been explored yet. But I think it seems apparent to me that there were intelligence agencies dealing with this at some level at some point. Again, whether that is the initial source of this information or whether they just got hold of it at some point and tracked down where it came from. At any rate, the NSA and the rest of, you know, the Five Eyes network and Echelon certainly do know where this ultimately originated from. But at the end of the day, I think one of the ramifications of all of this is not even going to be necessarily an issue about where the data came from, but how it's going to be used. And we've already, of course, seen all of the initial flood of reporting, of course, was all about Putin and Assad and Libya and other, you know, usual targets. But I think the more interesting story is ultimately going to be about the Panama itself and the idea of tax havens and what do we do about this. Surely what we need is further international cooperation on cracking down on this. Who could possibly be against that? And, oh, wouldn't you know it, this is already underway. In fact, 2 years ago, very quietly, to not much ballyhoo at all, at the Berlin Tax Conference of the OECD, there was already an agreement signed by 51 different countries, with 30 more waiting to come on board, that are about to, just next year, are going to start sharing information at the individual bank account level amongst each other. It's called the Mutual Competent Authority Agreement, the MCAA, and it's going to include account balances, interest, dividends, and sale proceeds from financial assets, not just on corporations, not just trusts, not just foundations, but individuals holding assets in any of the signatory nations. And it's all the major nations, of course, that you could imagine are signatories to this MCAA, except for countries like, well, Panama. Wow, wouldn't you know it? And now who's being demonized by in this leak and by proxy? It's Panama because of their vile secrecy laws, which, when you go and look up the Panamanian corporate law and where it was modeled and how it came into existence, it was created in 1927 and deliberately, specifically modeled on Delaware's laws, which brings us right back to the central tax haven, the developing real tax haven of the world, the United States, which itself is not a signatory to the MCAA and is quite boldly, defiantly saying it's not going to sign on to this agreement, which itself was modeled on the FATCA, FATCA, this global agreement that the U.S. is trying to strong-arm all of the traditional tax havens into being part of, that will share all of their information with the U.S. So there's so much swirling around this that all points back towards the real tax haven for the real global elite, which is the United States. And a lot of it is hidden quite not so much behind veils of secrecy as so much out in the open.
That's what, and so another point I made earlier today in a separate interview is that there's, you know, we're talking, okay, the Panama Papers, Mossack Fonseca, there's billions of dollars, sure, that have been moved through, you know, this law firm, and assets have changed hands and so forth. But this, to me, is really small fry compared to what goes on with, let's say, Citibank or Citigroup or HSBC on a global scale. And there's, you know, where were these journalists, James, with HSBC laundering huge amounts of illicit narcotic liquidity that basically kept some of these banks afloat during the financial crisis? Where were they, you know, during the heydays of, well, I don't think anyone who's gone to jail for BCCI, I don't know if anybody has actually, but we have that. We have a number of major banks. These are in New York. So the most amount of money is being laundered through New York and London and Switzerland and, you know, maybe Brussels. I don't know, but it's not in Panama. I mean, a lot goes through Panama, but you have huge amounts of deals and illicit trade going through major U.S. cities and Western European cities.
That's exactly right. The entire sort of offshore corporation law firm industry in Panama is equivalent to, so they say, about $500 million. So again, on the global scheme of things, small fry. Perhaps in terms of Panama's economy, it's important, but on the global scheme, relatively small, especially when you consider, as you say, I mean, even just look at one of those aspects of those banking scandals you talk about, HSBC convicted in 2012. This isn't speculation or theory. This is an actual conviction, convicted in 2012 of laundering nearly $1 billion of drug money for the bloodiest Mexican drug cartels. And they are now, in fact, in the process of being sued by the families of the victims of some of the HSBC-enabled drug trade that was going on there. They're also just received the largest fine in Swiss history for organizational deficiencies, that was the official quotation, that led to money laundering through the bank's Swiss subsidiary. But, of course, this is the same HSBC that federal investigators outright said to, I believe, the New York Times back a couple of years ago, they said that the bank was too big to prosecute. And then, of course, that turned into Attorney General Holder's infamous pronouncement, too big to jail, which was about HSBC and banks like it, which he then, of course, immediately backwalked. No, I didn't mean that. I mean, it's true, demonstrably, but I didn't mean to say that. But, of course, we then found out later on that the feds actually did help HSBC hide the drug money investigation from the press for years. So even the controlled, bought, and paid-for press that isn't going to print anything that it's not told to print, even so, they're still not even told. They're actively prevented from finding out about this by the federal investigators themselves, who are working hand-in-glove with these banks.
And that's some real there's some real meat in that story. I mean, this one, it's like, I don't know, this is like the Love Boat compared to like the other ones, like Star Wars. You know, this one is, there's nothing illegal, technically, at least from Panamanian point of view, or the British Virgin Islands. There's nothing illegal about going through these offshore companies. What it is it's a bit of eye candy. You've got Simon Cowell. You've got the sheikh from the UAE, the president of the UAE, Zayed Al Nahyan. You've got all these other high profile, Poroshenko, the candy man's even in there, Roshan candy mogul Petro Poroshenko.
Yes.
And so it makes for interesting, the cousin of Assad and, you know, childhood friends of Putin. It makes for interesting reading, but when you really drill down there, there's no gotcha. There's no, where's the crime? I think this is my theory, James, counterintuitive conspiracy theory, is that Mossack Fonseca is a law firm that is basically set up by the CIA. In fact, Earnhardt Mossack is the father of Jürgen, who runs the firm. He was a Nazi SS officer who was informing for the CIA after the war. He set up this firm, okay? That's what I believe, or ran it. And so it already has CIA pedigree. So I think there's something else that was going on behind the scenes. They wanted to close the book on this law firm. So they're saying, okay, before we close the book, let's see if we can create a little havoc here. Because it could be the case, James, where there's another offshore CIA playground that's being set up, and it's just about herding the elite away from Panama and sending the ones who are, quote, in the know into the next offshore secret haven. Who knows where that is? It could be in the South Pacific, or there's a number of
actually
candidates.
I have my own idea. It's not offshore at all. It's onshore. I mean, this was in fact a Bloomberg report from earlier this year. The world's favorite new tax haven is the United States. It is the U.S. is becoming the new tax haven. And again, this is part of all of those agreements that we were talking about before. For example, the OECD, the MCAA with the 50-plus signatories that's coming online, sharing all sorts of personal bank account information amongst all these different states. So, of course, they can crack down on the evil tax evaders and, oh, by the way, everyone else as well. But also, I mean, FATCA and all of those types of agreements, all of which center around the United States, but which the United States does not have to comply to. So it turns out that Nevada is quickly becoming one of the top tax haven stops for the world's global billionaires. And as such, guess who set up a wealth management trust very recently in Nevada? The Rothschilds, yes. Rothschild Rothschild Trust and Wealth Management? I forget the exact corporate name of it. Rothschild Trust North America, LLC.
Got money, go to Nevada, basically.
Well, yes, exactly. And in fact, I mean, this is a direct quote from Andrew Penny of Rothschild & Co., who was giving a speech in San Francisco to prospective clients of this trust recently, who said the U.S., quote, is effectively the biggest tax haven in the world. And then there was some leaked remarks that he was going to deliver at that speech that he ultimately ended up excising. But he was going to say that the U.S. lacks, quote, the resources to enforce foreign tax laws and has little appetite to do so, i.e., it's fair game for people to store all sorts of wealth in the United States and be shielded from all these international tax agreements that are being woven everywhere else. And interestingly enough, who shows up elsewhere in this Panama Papers in an interesting way? The FT, the Financial Times, I mean, Rothschild's pink edition there, has an interesting story about how Rothschild defends Poroshenko from Panama Papers. And it turns out that Poroshenko was using the Rothschild Group, the Rothschild Management Wealth Management Trust, to set up his Panama Paper, his foreign holdings. So they're eyeball deep in this. And, of course, they're also setting up what I think is the real tax haven, which is right there onshore, not offshore. The real money's going onshore.
And the reality is, James, that if you've got money, you can afford the law firm to do the paperwork for you. You can afford a chartered or a CPA in any country to do that side of things for you. If you've got money, you can move your money around and you can shield it through a series of offshore instruments and entities. The Cayman Islands, where people like Mitt Romney have laundered their billions for years. And there's a number of these places that if you've got the money, you can afford to fly there and sign papers twice a year, you know, things like this. Then if you have rich people know this amongst themselves. And so if you look at this story, it doesn't change anything. What you pointed out is very interesting in the United States on, you know, the offshore, onshore U.S. havens. But if you've got money, it doesn't really change anything because it's technically not illegal to move your money around in offshore shell companies and so forth. So it's inconsequential in many ways, but it sends a message to the feudal classes, the lower classes, that hey, you know, you couldn't do this even if you wanted to.
And you're right about all of that. And plus the fact that laundering money is, in fact, extremely easy through very different means. I mean, there are all sorts of fake transactions that can be set up through vaporware. I'm sure people have heard about. I mean, software can't really. I mean, how do you put a price on software? So you just put an extremely high price on it and pay the money through the system that way. Or set up an insurance deal that, again, you insure for way more than something is worth. And again, you can launder money that way. Or just go the Clinton route. Just give $250,000 speeches in front of banksters, and you know they can pass on money to your campaign through the back door or through the front door, really, because again, it's quite out there in the open. But hey, it was worth it.
And the fake loan scam as well, where you could say loan somebody or a company money in another country like Romania, for instance, and then you don't actually. They don't actually receive the money. Then they file a lawsuit and they get a local Romanian judge to sign off on an order that orders payment to a separate account in Moscow or in Prague or whatever. So there are these different international scams to basically shift money. And they're quite intricate if you check out some of them. They're very creative.
Yes, and a lot of them, again, difficult even once you pin it down to really prove anything, to really say that, well, you can't transact for this amount for this type of transaction. I mean, a lot of these things, again, you can put whatever price you want on them, so you can just move the money through the system that way, and that's how the big money and smart money operates, is through schemes like that. And they don't necessarily need these law firms in shifty places with shell companies in shiftier places. That, as you say, a lot of it is eye candy. And it certainly does sound important, but when you go to look through it, there's not a lot of there. And that's why Cameron can release all his tax documents for the last 6 years, and you're probably not going to find a lot of dirt in there because, again, I mean, all the important stuff has been brought through the back door through other means.
Yeah, and they are many countries have been forced to sign up to this U.S. Transparency International Cooperation Program. And I know if you go to half the countries, you go to them, if you're working in that country, you try to open a bank account, they will make you sign an IRS form, basically. And so you make a sort of declaration, and there's a contract signed at that point that those banks are going to cooperate with the U.S. authorities if they come knocking, that they hand over all the information. So this is going on globally. So this is interesting. If you get into a cashless society, you get away from paper. And everything is done electronically and you need an account to do it. Basically, you have a fully globalized, I don't know what to call it, but just complete control and knowledge of every single penny that moves on the planet, from at least from a U.S. government point of view.
Right, yeah. And it has to be stressed again how much strong-arming is going on diplomatically behind the scenes to get countries on board with this. And, I mean, Again, that Bloomberg report is talking about how Cayman was slammed back in December and closing things that people were withdrawing as they're starting to bring their regulations on board with this legislation. And of course, we know Switzerland has famously caved to FATCA and is starting to open some of the doors of the famously secret Swiss bank accounts. So you have a lot of money coming out of Switzerland right now. So there's a lot of pressure going on in this, and Panama was one of the notable holdouts, and it's probably not going to be a notable holdout for very much longer.
And you've got you've got a number of great CIA, and I noticed the banks aren't getting skewered in all of this. They've picked a law firm. I guess it's kind of like a symbolic patsy or something. But you know, you've got tons and tons of banks that are processing these, and you know, the Jane's Defense just released a report. I'm sure you saw it, detailing U.S. arms deals from the United States via Eastern Europe into Syria, into the hands of terrorists, let's say. And there you have the dockets, you have the requisitions, you know exactly what's going there. Some bank had to run that transaction at some point, and it would be an American bank or European bank. And so again, the banks kind of waltz through these crises or these scandals, but you have a number of CIA banks in Panama. Banco de Mexico, you've got the Bank Hoffman, that was an interesting one, BCCI, of course. Credit Suisse is even involved. It has been in the past in some of these shady CIA money laundering scandals. But, I mean, they seem to come off clean usually at the end of it, and everyone's focusing on the politicians or some of these law firms and shell companies that no one works there. It's just a name on a placard when you walk into Mossack Fonseca. They probably got 100 names up on the wall in little brass plates, you know, other companies they manage, I guess.
Yes, but, and basically the scheme is that you pay $1,000 for just a shell company, but you can pay extra to get a sham director appointed through Mossack Fonseca that will hide the actual shareholder and their identities. So it's a type of extortion basically going on for that. And again, I think the people who are using those services are probably at the lower levels of the ladder rather than the highest levels, except for, a few sheep that are going to get thrown to the wolves. And you know, what happened in Iceland and things like this is going to be held up as the example of, the world changing information. But I think you're right to point out that the banks kind of have the exact opposite situation as is going on with regards to the shell companies themselves. The shell companies are this incredible, it's catchy, it's interesting. People think, look, there's a shell company in a tax haven. There must be something, duplicitous going on, where that's not necessarily the case. But when you think about the banks that have to move this money, that actually are involved in the transferring of this, that's difficult. It's murky. You actually have to do some legwork on that, and it doesn't have the same pizzazz, so it won't be reported. It's guaranteed not to be reported, even if there weren't, banksters in control of the flow of information through the media. I think the media just wouldn't be gravitating towards stories like that because it's much less sexy. So the banks are shielded in a number of ways in a scandal like this.
I don't know if you saw this, but there's a kind of a link between the Panama Papers and these so-called Panama leaks, and the Operation Car Wash, which was this thing that I think Lula, the former socialist leader in Brazil, and Dilma Rousseff as well, they both got kind of snagged recently, or it was in the news anyway. I think it was in the end of last year, but in this kind of Operation Car Wash and this kind of like a data leak. This actually tracks back as well to Panama. And if you look at what happened, that was kind of a little bit of a fallout there in Brazil. And it also, I think, is going to have an effect on the political, kind of a political outcome in terms of maybe who sweeps into power next in Brazil could be a direct result of that so-called leak or this, Operation Car Wash, they called it. I don't know. That's translated from Portuguese, I guess.
But, that's right. Yeah. And I've heard that the translation of that is not precisely accurate and doesn't give quite the right idea of that. But yes, I hope people will look into that. I haven't done enough work on that specifically to be able to pontificate it on it. But there is that connection that over 100 accounts from the Panama Papers have been tied to Petrobras and the corruption that's being exposed or exposed in Brazil. But I heard a fascinating interview that Scott Horden was conducting the other day, and I can't remember the name of the individual, but it'll be up on his archives from just a few days ago, where he was talking about what's happening in Brazil as another example of this type of color revolution-ish warfare that's going on right now, where this democracy kind of warfare that's happening, where you get protesters spilling out on the streets in rage over corruption, sometimes valid corruption that really does go on, like in places like Brazil, but for political purposes and for certain ends. And it was an interesting and compelling argument, because I would be inclined, just based on what little I do know about the situation in Brazil, to think, well, there is corruption going on, so it all seems quite valid. But I think there's very much room for other motives to be happening in something like that, and for some of that anger to be directed towards felling political enemies of people that want to get certain people out of positions of power.
Yeah, so economicpolicyjournal.com. So I've got this headline, Panama Papers, Limited Hangout, economicpolicyjournal.com. So according to this article here, the Brazilian angle, basically, Panama links are directly related because of the fact that Ramon Fonseca, who has a 50% stake, I guess, in Mossack Fonseca, was dismissed as president of the Panamista Party last month because of Operation Car Wash, and was dismissed as president. And so this operation, this kind of investigation, targeted mostly ruling Workers' Party in Brazil. So the Panama Papers were in fact a monster truck version of Operation Car Wash. So they had Panama leaks in Brazil earlier in the year, last year, and so that was Operation Car Wash. So they're saying this is the child, if you will, of the Panama Papers. So the Panama Papers is like a monster truck version of Car Wash in a global sense. So that's up at economicpolicyjournal.com. If you can pop that into Google, folks, and just put Limited Hangout Panama Papers, and you'll see some details there. We'll try to get into that later in the week. But from a media angle, James, I want to ask you, how come there's no U.S. media firms in the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists except for McClatchy News? So McClatchy, I think, is the only U.S. media newspaper or news outlet in this illustrious consortium, yet it's getting all its money from U.S. foundations and Open Society and the Ford Foundation, Carnegie Endowment, USAID. But there's no U.S. media outlets except for McClatchy. And I once dug up some interesting stuff on McClatchy that I don't have at hand. But I am interested in this organization, and because they do cover some odd angles, let's say, on a number of big breaking stories. And I often wonder whether it's McClatchy itself is kind of, a Mockingbird type news outlet,
It certainly could be. I haven't done the kind of research to be able to verify that one way or another. But I think we do have to spend more time sort of looking at ICIJ and its role in not just Panama, but more generally in terms of controlling information on this level. But I think the other aspect of this that to me is fascinating, that I don't see, again, a lot of people talking about when it comes to the media and the reporting of this, is that we know that this information has been in the hands of these journalists, these hundreds of journalists, for a year now. And they have coordinated this to bring out the information at this time. For whatever reason, they've decided, April to start bombarding us with this information. But we know that this information has been out there for a year. We know they've been working on it, but it does raise the big question mark of various other revelations and things that have been going on. Who has been contacted about these leaks in terms of getting responses and starting to sort this story out? I mean, clearly Russia and other countries knew about this information weeks ago, at the very least, when they started pre-acting to the Panama Papers by saying there's going to be some information coming out, and it's all an op. So we know that this information has been floating around, and we know some people have been contacted in advance. who has had this information, how have they handled the information, and again, you raised the specter earlier of Operation Mockingbird. We know, admittedly, the CIA has in the past had journalists directly implanted in the media, friendly journalists, either on the payroll or simply friendly, that would work in CIA interests or let the CIA run an editorial under their byline. We know that that has gone on in the past, although they, you know, hand over heart, you know, two fingers in the air, pinky swear they'll never do that again. yeah, exactly. But so, I mean, that has to be a factor in a story like this. I mean, what are the odds that a intelligence-friendly journalist have gotten this, even if you're not the conspiratorial sort, and even if you think the ICIJ is, you know, butter wouldn't melt in their mouth? Clearly, there is someone somewhere who has gotten hold of this that has passed it on to some intelligence agency at some point. I mean, even at that level, and none of this is being even, of course, even mentioned as something to take into account when we look at the reporting of this. So there's so many different angles of this, and of course, all we get is, you know, exactly what we would expect to get, you know, WNYC making fun of myself and others for even raising these questions. So again, the counterintuitive conspiracy. So now it's not just that you have a conspiracy theory, it's that you don't have the officially sanctioned conspiracy theory.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, it's pretty, I mean, okay, I'm not defending the Chinese government or anything, but I was very suspicious at how fast they came out saying there was this story cascaded across every single media outlet that China was clamping down, the state censors were moving into action to muffle any talk of the Panama Papers, right? And then so I did a little searching, James, and I was looking for multiple sources, but I couldn't find multiple. I found one source of this, and this was the China Digital Times. And then so I'm looking at that and think most people who wouldn't bother to look or look it up would think, well, that's just an English language, a multi-international Chinese issue thing. But no, this is run out of UC Berkeley by Zhao Quang, and he is also involved with the Santa Fe Institute, which from my studies is very much linked with the U.S. intelligence establishment. He is also used to be vice chair of the World Movement for Democracy, which is funded by the U.S. State Department, National Endowment for Democracy. So he's a dissident who is basically holding court at UC Berkeley. And this could easily be anti-Chinese propaganda because it's only coming from this one source.
Yes, so yes, exactly. And that's so important when we look at a place like China. We have to know there is absolutely no media that comes out of there that is not slanted heavily in some direction. I mean, there's only really pro-government, basically government mouthpieces, or there is this, you know, over-the-top propaganda that comes out of there against anything Chinese. So you've got Want China Times and things like this on the sort of, you know, the Taiwanese side and the anti-Chinese government side, or you have the China Daily or things like that are clearly just government mouthpieces, and you have nothing in between. So it's extremely hard to get anything that you can really sink your teeth into out of China, except for occasionally when you get a little bit of the cover blown by certain things. There was that huge story that Bloomberg ran a few years ago about the real oligarchs of China and the incredible wealth that they've amassed in their families and how that's basically dwindled down through the generations. And that incredible story and that incredible reporting that was done on it ultimately ended up in a lot of Bloomberg reporters getting, you know, basically either fired or shoved out or quitting because of the way that information was being handled. Surprise, surprise. So you'll occasionally get some interesting reporting, but it will be immediately clamped down on.
Mm. Yeah, I think you said nothing in between. And, you know, The Guardian should be in between. And some of these news outlets should be the in between, but they're not. And I think I see this with the coverage about Syria and so many other issues, that the Western media seems to have gravitated into this kind of weird zone. I include the Washington Post and the papers of record, the New York Times, where they seem to be repeating what the important people are saying. So, and to hell with the facts. And they're not even embarrassed And Robert Perry penned a very good article in the last week about this, about kind of the sad state of journalism, especially in the United States, where they got away with it in Iraq in 2003. And that seemed to be some of the same people or in the same positions that were, say, defending weapons of mass destruction, including the editorial editor of The Washington Post. His name is Hyatt. I forgot his last name or his first name, but... And now he's saying that Obama failed because he wasn't aggressive enough and he let Assad cross the red line. Meanwhile, Assad wasn't launching chemical weapons attacks. That was being done by the moderate rebels. But those facts seem to be lost on all these so-called journalists. And so they're running these narratives out in the mainstream on headlines across CNN, across Fox, across ABC, even Charlie Rose, you know, and all these sort of great legends of journalism. They all seem to be, I don't know, it is Mockingbird, actually, because Mockingbirds copy each other. And that's what
exactly, this is yes. What, and that's where the name comes from. And that's exactly the effect they intended to have. You only need a few real, you know, leaders in any field to dominate the field as a whole, because most people will just parrot what they hear. And that's exactly the case with regards to that original Mockingbird program. But who knows how it's evolved since it went underground. Or further underground, but yes, I mean you raise some valid points there, and again, I think when we look at these questions of intelligence and media and how that's changed things, but I think there's a couple of things going on. One is there is a demonstrable real change in reporting that is going on for a number of reasons. I mean, just the business model of journalism has changed, and that has had an effect, and there is a reduction in actual investigative journalism at the expense of, you know, writing clickbaity headlines and using advertising models on the internet as a way of generating revenue and dwindling subscribers and to print media and things of that nature has really changed some of the journalism. But I think to a certain extent, when I reflect back on my own view of it, I certainly do see that, and I do think about that and how it didn't seem quite so blatant, the type of propaganda that was happening, say, 20 years ago, as opposed to what's happening today. But I think to a certain extent, that might just be a reflection of my own understanding of what was happening and our ability to access other points of view. Perhaps there's a sense in which the media has to gravitate towards the propaganda nodes even more closely, because now people have access to alternative points of view. So you have to you can't sort of balance those, or at least make sort of, you know, gestures towards that anymore. Now you have to cleave very closely to authority to reinstill in the dwindling public that is still actually listening to them the sense that only authority is are the only places to turn when you're looking for information on things like this. So I think there's a number of factors that lead up to the sort of decline of journalism that we've seen, startlingly, even in my own rather limited lifespan, and I think probably even more startlingly when you look at a longer lifespan.
I agree with you on all that. And I also think, and I'm going to get your comment as well on this idea, is I think there's also kind of an ivory tower. There is this kind of celebritization or this celebrity aspect to some of these mainstream journalists and anchors and people who have, you know, they host their own shows on the big networks, and also people who are columnists in like the Washington Post or the Times and so forth, that they're not accessible. You know, they don't run their own social media pages. If you work for a major network affiliate in the U.S., if you're on Facebook, you have to be on their Facebook. In other words, it will be your name and then the call sign of the station or the media organization. So you can't be there as a private citizen. That's kind of some of the restrictions that they have for their employees, and which I think is kind of an interesting thing in itself. But they, you know, so they can afford to get it wrong, is what I'm saying, and they don't really have to face the public. They don't have to engage in a real, you know, vicious debate in the comment section below the line. When I wrote a piece one time for a major newspaper, and I got into the scrum below the line, and that was okay because maybe I wasn't so well known. But they just – so I can't – what I'm saying, James, is I can't afford to get it wrong. And I know you can't – we can't afford to get it wrong in the world that we run in. And so when you're talking about these issues, as you were in the previous couple minutes, you're qualifying what you're saying. But we don't see the mainstream media or these so-called journalists who graduate from Syracuse, from New York University, from Columbia, from all the top journalism schools. They're not doing any qualifications. They're running basically with whatever the State Department line is on something, or the John Brennan CIA line, or whatever the government's saying. Basically, this is what they're running with. So they get it wrong. And then you'd think if they got it wrong, there would be some shame involved, or you'd think that they could get fired, or if you get something really wrong, like you insist publicly for months that Saddam is hiding his WMDs, like the editor of the Washington Post, you'd think you'd be fired. And I see he's still got the same job 15 years later. It's incredible.
Right. On the issue of celebrity journalists, are you telling me that Anderson CIA intern Cooper isn't a hard-hitting journalist, or, Wolf Mossad Blitzer isn't a hard-hitting journalist?
I see Cooper in more movies now. I don't know if you see any films, but they have these CNN little snippets that appear in films and major TV shows like The Good Wife and others, and Madam Secretary. So Cooper and all these people get a lot of screen time acting, basically. So they are actors, essentially. They're not journalists. I can tell you that for a fact. In fact, if they ever run out of crisis actors, then they'll be the last ones to be doing the crisis acting. You'll see Cooper with a bandage around his head and some blood dripping down his whatever, and he will be the last crisis actor when they finally run out.
Well, say what you want about him, but his Q score must be right off the charts. So there you go.
Yeah, I'm sure he does very well on standardized tests as well.
But not IQ, his Q score, his watchability quotient or whatever they use in the business. So he's...
Yeah,
you can't take your eyes off him.
Yeah, so that it is a kind of sorry state of affairs, and unfortunately, we're going to have to deal with it for some time in the future. But the last thing that regarding the Panama Papers was the ICIJ released a video that was kind of like a childish kind of little instructional video of what the Panama Papers were, and they even employed an actor with an Eastern European kind of, I don't know, accent, and then talking about Assad's cousin supplying fuel to the Syrian Air Force as if this was some sort of a crime. Meanwhile, we have the Turkish president's son basically fingered for shipping oil, getting oil from ISIS and selling it for cash. I think there's a warrant out for his arrest. I think he's in Italy, or he's just fled Italy. I can't remember. But that's like a real scandal. And then I watched this video. In a way, the Panama Papers, it's a great distraction for a number of real things going on. What's happening in Yemen right now is the story of the decade. I mean, we have not seen a war of aggression like this that Saudi Arabia is waging against Yemen, and with the full cover of the United Nations, because Saudi's on the head of the UN Human Rights Council. It probably bought their way on there. And that, to me, I mean, these are giant scandals involving the UN, Ban Ki-moon, cluster bombs being, dropped on civilians in Yemen. And then all they've got for us is the Panama Papers.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right. And yeah, I hope your listeners will go and watch that Victims of Offshore video that they have up on YouTube, because it is cartoon. I mean, it's literally a cartoon, so it's cartoonish in that sense. But it's just ridiculous propaganda that's presented so matter-of-factly and so succinctly that basically Assad is the beginning, end, and middle of all evil that is happening in Syria. And so anything even remotely related to supplying the Syrian army must be just, it's because Assad is crazy and just wants to kill his own people. So, you're on board with hating him, right? I mean, it is so childish, it is so cartoonish, and it really does beggar the imagination that people are falling for it. So I'm glad to see that there are, from my perspective, there are more and more people who are not falling for it. And I'm glad to see that my Panama Papers video has already cracked the 100,000 view mark and is being targeted by WNYC and others, because, real analysis tends to get out, and the lies and garbage that they put over does not get a lot of traction.
So you should give a big shout out to WNYC and thank them for helping your video get to more people.
Exactly right. Yeah.
So big shout out to WNYC. There's a shout poll at 21st Century Wire right now. We've got a shout poll up, which is, are the Panama Papers a genuine leak or are they a limited hangout? We've already got a number of votes already in there. Currently, 60% of our readers say that it's a limited hangout, 40% a genuine leak. So hopefully we'll get some more votes. Get in there and have your shout. Let's hopefully get a few hundred more by the end of today, and let's have your shout. There's a number of other polls that have concluded as well. Is Saudi Arabia guilty of war crimes in Yemen? Overwhelmingly, yes. And is the U.S. helping or hindering the fight against ISIS? Overwhelmingly, our readers say hindering. 80% say hindering the fight against ISIS, not helping. So have your shout. Get in there and vote. And James, before we go, we just want to say thank you for your timely analysis on the Panama Papers. And getting that out so quick, and also helping to get the conversation steered into what I think is a more productive direction. So we do appreciate that, and we appreciate your time. Before you go, give us our listeners as well a shout out of what you're working on now and where you work, your website, and so forth.
Yes, thank you for that. Well, I'm working on all the usual stuff, interviews, and well, I have another podcast that I'm going to be working on, a follow-up to my Big Oil documentary that people might have seen a few months ago. I'm still working on that behind the scenes. So a lot more information spilling out all the time through CorbettReport.com. That is the one-stop shop for all of my work, CorbettReport.com. Thousands of hours now of media, audio, video, articles that are there for free download that I hope people will use as an information resource, and I hope it's just the start of people's explorations rather than trying to be the be-all and end-all, but that's the site to go to, CorbettReport.com.
We've got a link to that on our show page just next to James's name. On the show page, you'll see a link to the Corbett Report, so go ahead and check out. Like James said, it's a great place to start your investigations and your explorations as a reader and an interested citizen, a consumer of news. So thank you very much, James Corbett, for your time and for your contributions today.
Thanks again for having me on. I appreciate it.